My name's Nicole Lloyd-Jones and it's the 15th of May 2015 and I'm at Causey Manor interviewing Ray Goodswin. Ray, tell me, where were you born and where did you live when you were young?
I was born in Norfolk, so I spent the first 18 years of my life there.
Yeah.
Educated at Wyndham College, which was an interesting place simply because it was the first state co-educational boarding school. I then went to Exeter, Luke's College in Exeter University, and went to teach in Northamptonshire at a public school for a couple of years. Moved into the state sector, eventually ending up in Cornwall. Spent 10 years teaching in Cornwall as a head. Actually, it was the third largest school in Cornwall in primary sector.
And how did you first get interested or involved in traditional dance or music?
Started at university.
Yep.
Yeah. Interesting progression is that the first year, you're the newbie with two left feet. In the second year, you're the slightly more experienced. And because everybody leaves majority leave after 3 years, suddenly you're the expert.
Yeah.
With the new people coming in, so I started calling.
Mm-hmm.
And it progressed from there. When I went into teaching, I started teaching children.
Excellent.
Moved to Cornwall and went from teaching children to teaching teachers to teach children to dance.
Excellent.
And then got into doing public dances. One Saturday, I had a phone call from a local band, and the chap said, "I hear you do calling." I said, "Yeah, I work at the teacher centre, teaching teachers." He said, "Would you like to do a barn dance?" I said, "Yeah, I'd be very interested." "When?" "Tonight."
No.
I said, "Well, yes. Where?" And it was at a little village called San Creed, which is about 10 miles west of Penzance. Mm. So way down. So, yeah, I got prepared. I went down. And I hadn't worked with many bands before that. Most of my stuff had been recorded music. The village hall was literally a tin shack.
Yeah.
And when I got them really dancing and balancing, the hall almost seemed to sway with them.
Yes.
And you learn very quickly. I told the band what I wanted, reels, what I was going to do. And one of the first dances I did was a four-couple dance. Well, with my record, after four times through, the record stopped. But of course, when you're working with a band, after four times through, unless you tell them you want them to stop, they keep playing.
Yes.
So we did it twice.
That sounds fun. So how did you first get involved in Halsey Manor from Cornwall?
Going to dance weekends in 1986, and it's a long way on, I became interested in extending my knowledge of dancing.
Yeah.
And started to go away to various dance weekends.
Yeah.
And one of the callers from North Devon, two callers from North Devon, Ron Beeson and Joe Trapnell. Ron is sadly now deceased and Joe's in her mid-80s and a bit frail. But they were running a North Devon weekend, to which I got invited, and they were doing a week at Halsey.
Oh.
And I came on that, and that was my first experience of Halsey. The lady I was dancing with at the time had been to Halsey before.
What year was that?
That was 1986.
Yeah.
Fran had been here in 1967-ish.
Yeah.
So she was one of the first. And it had changed, obviously, over those years, but once you've been to Halsey, you just get the bug.
Yeah.
It leaves an impression. dancing in that long room with live music was just wonderful. So I was hooked, and then started coming more regularly to their weekend and to other weekends when I could, because life was hectic and it was a long way to travel. I was getting involved with Sidmouth Festival, Eastbourne Festival, visiting other festivals around the country. So Halsey was one of many, but it was something you treasure. You come here, it's small enough that you feel at home and large enough to make you feel special.
Yeah.
So to me, that's the essence of Halsey, really. And to wake up and look out at the ground here. I think the most memorable occasion is to wake up and see a deer eating on the lawn. That was really quite something. So yeah, that's how I became involved with Halsey.
And what was going on at Halsey around that time when you first came, and how did that develop over the years?
The things in which I was interested were the dance weekends, or weeks, and they were the only things of which I was aware at that time. I used to think that Halsey was such a special place that it must be run by, you know, some gods of the folk world. Really did. I didn't know who these eminent people were who ran such a fantastic place. And it wasn't until 2004 that myth was displaced, as it were, and attended an AGM. And I saw the people who were the chairman, the treasurer, and some of the other board members, and I thought, oh my God, they can do that. I could do something to help here.
Yeah.
I wonder how. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the AGM, I went up to John Turner, who was the current finance director, and said, how does one get onto the board to be influential in this place, to give something back? And he said, would you be interested? I said, I would. Oh, right. And the next week, I got a phone call to ask me if I would go to the next board meeting. And I couldn't go in straight away, but they would be discussing co-opting me onto the board.
Yeah.
So from October 2004, I was co-opted onto the board at Halsey Manor.
And what did that mean?
It meant a steep learning curve.
Yes.
I came, having left teaching back in 76, I'd started my own business. And you very quickly learn what it's all about running a business. And I had a very much a business brain. I was into business plans, I was into financial plans and so on. So I attended the first board meeting, and I remember at the end of it saying that it was interesting discussion, but in order that I could get up to date with everything, could I please have a copy of their strategic plan for the next 5 years? And there was a stunned silence round the table. And then Euphine Brommel, who'd been on the board forever, said, well, back in 90-something or other, we did a business plan for a year. I think that's still about. And I just said, but how do you mark off your achievements? How do you know whether you're on target to achieve what you're trying? And there was no, at that time, no strategic, no business plan, nothing. Alan Corkett was a board member who volunteered and did the artistic program. We had a manager running the hotel side of things who had no knowledge of folk activities whatsoever. He was charged with making it profitable, and so he concentrated on the things that he knew. Business courses, selling space to Somerset County Council or whatever, West Somerset, getting people in to fill the hall, the accommodation, if possible, he would make them residential courses. But it was, there weren't as many bums in beds as there should have been. And so things progressed from there. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but...
Okay, thank you.
So, I was on the board, and we were then looking at how we could improve, because we knew we needed to put more people in the beds, but we needed to improve the artistic programme. And after a lot of soul-searching, we decided that... the better way, rather than having a hotel manager and the programme being decided by a volunteer, that we should actually employ a professional as a chief exec. We were going to call them chief officer initially, to do an artistic programme, and that the running of the manor should fall into place after that. The very hard decision was having to make the current manager redundant, and that meant we were therefore without anybody for, well, it was going to be 3 or 4 months at least, going through the interview process. And at that point I worked with Alan Corkett, with the current chairman, and did a bit of programming, helped to run the manor and so on. We appointed a lady with a very good artistic background, but not in folk, and realised very quickly we'd made a mistake. So she served her 6 months probationary and then left. So we were without again, and it was at that point I came in to work, actually, as a volunteer, but to work in the manor. I was spending 3 days a week here, and doing the programming, working in the office with Viv and with Angie. We developed the programme. We changed from... I introduced the more professional leaflets. We used to print our own and fold them. Everything done in-house. And you start looking at other people's leaflets and you realise we actually looked a bit amateurish. So we put it out to a professional company to print. And when you actually worked the cost out, it didn't cost that much more. And you were getting a more effective, more professional-looking document that you could put out everywhere. It could go to libraries and not stand out as the, oh, my God, don't want to know that. Then we appointed Anthea Dean as chief exec. And she stayed for barely 2 years and decided to retire to Scotland. So we were without again for nearly 6 months, and I came back in and worked alongside the current chairman, Robin Williams. He did the staffing side and I did everything else. So I've done lots of things here.
Yes.
I've waited on table, I've been the MC at weddings, and I've worked in the office. That time we started to develop the programme in a different way. We were doing the professional leaflets, but we thought we could perhaps do more, because people wanted to know what was on for the year rather than just each event. So we were looking at doing, I think they're called A6, which is half A5 leaflets, and in order that we could put more things in the whole year or 6 month programme. We didn't actually get to that. Paul James was appointed, and I'm pleased to say he actually took that up, and we now produce an A6 leaflet with the year's programme in, which is lovely. And it's all done professionally, printed. Yeah, there are costs involved, but the costs are outweighed by the income it generates, because it gets to more people, bringing more people in. And therefore, I've been able to express my enthusiasm for folk dance through that.
Yes.
But we've also widened the programme to further things other than just dance. Yeah. Much more music, song, and other things. I was in the fortunate position, as far as the dance world is concerned, to having lots of contacts, because in 1995 I had taken over as dance director at Sidmouth Festival. I was there doing that for 13 years, so it overlapped with my time on the board at Halsey. And then before I finished at Sidmouth, I'd taken over Eastbourne Festival as well as the director of the festival, because the committee there decided to give up. So my contacts in dancing were wide, but having wide contacts in dancing meant you got introduced, particularly at Sidmouth, to other areas to get people involved. But it's interesting how you relate that back to the influences in my dancing career. Because I started dancing in Exeter, and at that time there's a lady involved whose name is carried on into this building, into the library. Margaret Grant was the area representative of the English Folk Dance and Song Society. She came across as a very stern lady, but she actually had a heart in the right place, and she loved her dancing. And then there was her, there was Irene Harcourt, there's a chap called Colin Mayfield, and of course the man in the area was Bill Rutter.
Yeah.
In addition to that, later on I also met Peter Kennedy. When I was on the board at Halsey, Peter Kennedy contacted us to talk about his fantastic collection of material, and I was fortunate enough to go and visit him in his home, and I saw his collection, and he's very proud to show it off. He had this Edwardian house in Gloucester, and the two downstairs rooms, which were tall, the walls were lined with bookcases full of folk material. Down in the basement, he had shelves upon shelves filled with records and recordings and instruments from his time busking on Gloucester Keys and so on. Anyhow, he was interested in giving it to Halsey, he said, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to attach strings. He wanted an apartment in Halsey so that he and his wife could live in Halsey with all his material. And I had to explain to him that that actually wasn't practical. We couldn't do that. In spite of the fact he was going to make a gift. And I said also that if he just gave it, he had to be aware of implications. So we agreed anyhow. I drew up a deed of gift, and he signed that all his material on his death would come to Halsey Manor, but Halsey would be responsible for the transporting of that to here. Sadly, he died within probably a year of doing that.
Yeah.
But in the in-between time, he'd set up another charity with a local group of folk singers.
Oh.
And he told them they could have all his material. The fortunate thing was he'd done nothing in writing with them, and we had the deed of gift. So we had a couple of meetings with them here with his son David. And the ultimate thing was we got all the material, with the exception of the recordings that he had done of folk people. A bit like Cecil Sharp, only Cecil Sharp didn't have recording material like Peter had. that stuff went to the National Archive, who are doing, supposedly, when the time is right, recordings of it and digital copies. And we are entitled to a digital copy eventually of all that material. But all the other stuff came here. There were boxes. We had over 4,000 books, 3,000 records, tapes and musical instruments. And I have to say, the Sartins have done a wonderful job in sorting through all that and assimilating it into the existing library, because some of it duplicated. And that's why we then made the decision as a board, this would become the Kennedy Grant Memorial Library. Because, yeah, the other stuff came from Kennedy's. We do get additional gifts from other people. And it's lovely to receive these things, but sometimes they're not necessarily applicable or suitable, or they duplicate, and that's where the librarian has to exercise their say-so. You can't keep everything. We are not a pawn shop or whatever. You know, we just do not. And other things that have influenced me and over the years, there are so many exceedingly good callers and dancers, enthusiasts. There are people who turn up regularly, which is wonderful. The callers, I mentioned Ron Beeson and Joe Trapnell, because they were just local callers, North Devon, but their influence was considerable. But then you get other people, John Chapman. John Chapman has written a dance called Crocombe 274, which was the telephone number here. It still is. I know it's 01984-618-274. In those days, it was Crocombe 274. And he has recorded, he has written that. People like Alan Corkett, who's written tunes, Halsey Manor, which goes with book tunes in the Halsey Hamper. And then along those lines, when Halsey was 40 years old, we obviously had some Ruby celebrations, and we encouraged people to actually write a dance for Halsey. And I edited a book called The Halsey Ruby Selection, and it's a book of dances written by various people around the country. Jeff Elwell, Fiona Birchall comes to mind, John Wood, Francis Oates, myself, I've got a couple in there, to celebrate the 40 years of Halsey Manor. Some of them, I think, are meant to illustrate little bits about the manor, but others are just because people have got fond memories of it and wanted to record material. Now, of course, with the 50 years, we're looking for people to do so again.
Yeah.
And this time we're going to make it a wider collection. It's not only going to be dances. We're looking for songs, we're looking for poems, we're looking for tunes. Anything of the tradition that can be put together into a collection. And whether that goes out in print or whether it goes out in digital format has yet to be decided, but we'll get the collection together. I've already had a Belgian, Philippe Callens, who has contacted me to say, I've written a dance for Halsey Manor and a tune.
Marvellous.
I'm very happy that you use that. And an American lady, Mary Devlin, who has done the same, dance and tune, that she's happy to include. So we're on the way. We're waiting for a few more contributions. Just to change tack slightly, from the board perspective, one of the things we've noticed over the years is the changing of people's needs and requirements and wants and desires whereas Halsey in its initial years was run a bit like a youth hostel, and people were happy to share multiple bedded rooms. A number of the people who came originally as young people are still coming now, they're 40, 50 years older.
Yeah.
And they would rather have their own suites.
Yes.
So initially the Muse was en-suited. People have funny ideas. This is me as a businessman probably looking at it slightly differently. But the Muse was initially converted with volunteer labour and done as cheaply as possible. And there are showers in there with shower curtains that love to wrap themselves around you when you're showering and so on. And it loses some of its attraction after the first once or twice. So, yeah, to me, I'd have stepped back and I'd have said, we do it professionally. You do a first-class job first time rather than continually spending money to bring it up to scratch. And also, it lends itself, the Muse, to quite amusing stories. Room 32 is not ensuited, but it has a private bathroom just across the corridor. And I have had a personal experience of going out early in the morning to the bathroom, and the bedroom door, because the window was open, shutting firmly behind me, and I didn't carry the key in my pyjama pocket. So there I was, stranded outside my room in my PJs and not being able to get back in. And I had to phone over, fortunately there is a phone over there, to reception, and the lady on duty was Lynn Pope, who had been here many, many years. And I said, Lynn, I need some help. Bring a key, quick, for him. And I had to wait outside the room until she arrived with the key to let me back in. Now when I use room 32, I ask for two keys, and I leave one in the bathroom to make sure. So that happens. We then worked very hard and got planning permission to ensuite the whole of the east end of the manor. And every room actually had permission, including room 11, which has the priest hole, which goes into a little room above the porch. And we were given permission to convert that, but there was no way the plumber could find of getting water into there to do it. So that one remains not ensuited. We changed the ladies' toilet at the top of the landing as well. There used to be three cubicles in there. In order to put an ensuite in room 7, we took part of the bathroom. The bathroom took part of the toilet. So we ended up with one toilet. And the architect, Peter Swan, actually did the drawings at that time. And he drew it up very nicely. You go in, but the toilet was actually at right angles as you went in the door. And what hadn't been thought of was that actually, if you sit on a toilet at right angles in a very narrow cubicle, when you stand up, you bang your head on the opposite wall. And so having put it in, we had very quickly to turn it through 90 degrees. It only required an L-bend, but on paper that hadn't been seen. So that was amusing. The ladies' toilets downstairs in the main building were designed, and Peter again obviously consulted his wife and decided that ladies wanted a large powder room but only needed two cubicles. So at the end of a dancing session, the ladies are always queuing, and the men don't have that problem, fortunately. And really and truly, with a bit of forethought, you could have got three cubicles in there, no problem, with a bit less room to powder your nose. But these are things that will come out in the wash, and certainly with the new plans, the architects seem to have covered things differently. I think the new plans are very exciting. We know something has to be done. Having a dance room that will only really dance 48 maximum comfortably, you need something else. In order to do that, you've got to be able to accommodate more people. As I said earlier, people nowadays want their ensuite bedrooms. They don't want to share five to a room and then run along the corridor to the bathroom. It's not a modern feature. They really don't see it.
Did it used to happen that way?
It's how it is now.
How it is now.
If we go to the West End, the Victorian part, you've got room one, which is a five-bedded room, room three, four beds, room four, four beds, room six, four beds. And they all share one shower room. Mm-hmm. Two toilets along the corridor. In addition to that, you've got a single room in room five and a double room in room two. So you've got, if they're all full, you've got a lot of people queuing for a bathroom. So yeah, additional accommodation, some twin double rooms with en suites, absolutely essential. Then if you fill all of those, you need the bigger space for dancing. So the logic is there. The one thing we mustn't lose is the Halsey atmosphere. Because that's what brings people back, time and time again. People who come here for the first time love it. There are very few people who come and say, I'm never going back to that place. Very few. There were some in the probably late 80s, early 90s, who came when the food was a bit iffy. There are still people I talk to going round the country calling, and you say, oh, have you been to Halsey? Oh yeah, I went there once. Oh, when was that? Oh, must be 30 years ago. Food was dreadful. I said, you really want to change it and try it again. Because now the food is of a consistently high standard, probably more than you need on most occasions, and you won't be disappointed. So we have built up over the years in some quarters a little barrier, but gradually we're ironing out the wrinkles. People are coming back, being brave enough to come and find out what is really here and to thoroughly enjoy it. On the dance front and dance music side, it's a wonderful venue for dance musicians. There have been two CDs recorded. We had a Millennium CD where musicians came and spent a week here and then recorded the music at the end of it. And we had, then 10 years later, they recorded another CD. So you've got the Millennium Plus CD. You get, musicians actually love to come here. We have, actually, I suppose I started this out. Because when I was at Sidmouth, we had an American band over to do the week at Sidmouth. Because they were over here, it was actually cheaper to then get them to come on and do a week at Halsey, and similarly at Eastbourne. And you've just had this week the Stringrays, I will call them Stingrays, Rodney Miller and Max, and I've forgotten his name, but I'll get back to that. But the trio, and they were at Eastbourne, and they've now done a week here before they go on and finish their tour of the UK. And that way, by working in cooperation, you can get the big-named American bands over. We had Bare Necessities. We've had Rodney and his other guys of Air Dance. So, and they want to come. Mary Devlin, I mentioned earlier, who's written a dance for Halsey. She was over here. Lisa Greenleaf Sis Hinkle, Gary Rudman, who is, well, world famous for the number of dances that he's composed. I think he's probably on his 10th or 11th book now of dances, many of which are very good. He has been here for a week. And an English caller, John Turner, does a weekend of Rudman dances. That's now in its third or fourth year and is popular. So we get the big names. Philippe Callens has been over a number of times, working with Andrew Shaw, probably one of the better known English style callers in England. I think callers actually enjoy coming to Halsey. Many of the nationally known callers, and some of them even organise their own clubs, so they do partnership events. John Chapman used to do so. His wife Dee continues that for their club. We've got Mary Irison's club. Mary Irison celebrated her 100th birthday. She still comes. She was 101 this year and still brings her group early in the year to Halsey. So there are people who've been dancing for many years who come back time and time again. Ken Sheffield, who's written the Two Barnes Books series, he used to run a week in August. Ken is now sadly not the best of health and so doesn't come anymore, but they're part of the history of Halsey. They've been involved over the years. And probably a man who needs a mention, who's not nationally famous, is Dick Little. Dick is a dancer, 85 years old, still dancing, was for many years chairman of the Halsey Board, and a great folk enthusiast, and works very hard behind the scenes.
Yeah.
For the folk movement and the dance movement in particular. There's often a lot of talk in dancing about, oh, we can't get young people in. I would just say, you know, you need to go to Sidmouth Festival in particular, and the late night extra there, which starts at 11, half past 11 at night and goes on till 1:30. And it's a large marquee, crammed full, 250, 300 younger people. And they dance. They're at university or of that age. And all I say is, we've got to sow the seeds to them there. They will then probably go off, married, have families, have careers, which interfere with their dancing. But if we've whetted their appetites enough, when they get to their mid to late 40s, then they'll think about, I used to enjoy that. Wonder if there's somewhere I can do it locally. And they're the people we've got to encourage. It is changing. People like Paul Hutchinson, Paul Sartin, Belshazzar's Feast, and in their separate guises in other things, are doing things to encourage youngsters. The Zesty Playford, the Zesty Contra, Zesty literally meaning it's a lively word, is getting youngsters involved. Young callers like Bob Morgan, who are running weeks, Rodri Davis running weeks, and the younger people are beginning to come. Here, it's a case of, if you do it at a weekend, they've got to leave work on Friday, rush down. It's an expensive, it's a long way for many of them to come, and it's expensive, so we have to bear that in mind. Paul started to do a lot more for young people, using our bursary, because for many years we've had bursaries for young people to aid them to come. We were sadly hiding it. It wasn't open enough knowledge to the public, the more we can get it out there, we'll get the young people involved. They have got to have a change of attitude, however. I have noticed running festivals, you get young people who go to university courses now, who think they're going to leave university and get five-figure salaries easily in the folk world because they've been to university. You don't get that. You've got to earn it. You've got to work at your art form and find something else to support you as well, or do something slightly different professionally. Write music, write books, lecture tour, whatever. You won't get it from just playing for a Saturday night dance. It won't pay its way. People can't afford to book you. It's got to be sensibly priced to attract the people. Courses here, very interesting ideas of profit sharing. Get involved. Then you work for your own ends. You're encouraging people to come to your events. The other thing you do, we have done over the years, these partnership events are really key to the manor, because a local group organises its own, it sells its tickets, just books the bed and breakfast, or full board, whatever, at the manor, and pay for that, then they pay their own staff. Therefore their pricing can be differently, their events can be priced differently to those at the manor, who have to bear the whole cost of the event. But it works. If we can fill the beds, then we're achieving our ends, and that's what it's all about. I've recently been working with a Scottish country dancer. We run a week here called the Anglo-Scottish Week. Now, we had 40 people this year for the whole week. Many of them were Scottish country dancers, but were keen to explore the difference and to do some English dancing. There were English dancers who were equally keen to discover the Scottish side of things. They see them as totally different genres. But once you get below the surface, there are so many things that are similar. Some movements have the same name and are different. Other movements are the same. And it's more of this crossover that we need to do. We need to get more integration. We have a weekend here, the long weekend, first May bank holiday. We have an international event. At the same time, the Eastbourne International Folk Dance Festival is running, which has an international section. The great sadness to me is that those two international groups, part of CIFID, the Society for International Folk Dancers, and they don't talk to each other, and they won't go to each other's events. And we've got to break down these barriers.
Where do people come from for the international?
All over the country. It's actually interesting. You can put on an international folk dance event and staff it with people who know the dances of, let's say European dances, the Balkans, the Yugoslavia, Italy, French, and all of those people can live in this country. Even when I did Eastbourne one year, we had some Thai dancing, we had an Indian group, we had some, well, I'll call them Middle Eastern dances. Basically, they were belly dancers. And they were doing dancing from Egypt, as well as Lebanon and other Middle Eastern countries. Turkey, that was another one that stuck out. All of those forms of belly dancing that we call it are actually different styles. So, because we are such a multicultural society, you can find all of those in this country. You can bring them in from abroad, we have done. I was negotiating with a Nepalese team to come over, because they actually get funding from their government to go on international trips and take their art abroad, as long as they can show that they've got a contract to perform, they can get funding to come. So it is possible, but you need to give sort of a year's notice in order to work it. Dancing, people are frightened that dancing is dying out, and I don't believe it for one little bit. The more we do, the university courses and their numbers are increasing, it's going to continue, even if it changes. And that's all about the tradition. It evolves. The things that Sharp collected and wrote down will be different from the things that Playford collected. And Playford's collections of dances, and I really do think it's worth emphasising the fact he wasn't a dancing master. He was a publisher, a big, fat, rich publisher from Norwich. And the collections of dances he produced, if you actually read the manuscripts, they're not as clear as they might be. What does he mean when he says you turn? He doesn't say what sort of turn it is. And this sort of thing. Sharp interpreted it in one way, Shaw interpreted it in another. Andrew Shaw is now looking again and interpreting others. And there are many people over the years who've just changed the interpretation to make it fit the music better. Now you're getting into the zesty Playford. Those people are taking the dances and thinking, well, actually, we could do that to a different tune. People like Chris Turner, who introduced the Maypole back to Halsey and has done a lot of teaching here. He's run Christmas courses, New Year's Eve, February Frolics, June Japes. He's very happy to do the traditional dances to tunes that fit them, any tune, and he'll put the figures to it. And it works. There are obviously some dances you can't do that, but the majority you can. And if it gets people dancing, so be it. As I said, it's the way the tradition evolves. I can go to a dance and call a dance, possibly one of my own, matters not. Somebody can write that down and take it off and call it somewhere else. And you can see it being done and you think, oh, I know, yeah. They've actually got the third part of that very slightly differently, because what they've written down, they haven't actually understood quite what they meant by their notes. But again, it's how it evolves. And it's why you've got dances. Haste of the Wedding is an example. You've got a Haste of the Wedding from Dorset and a Haste of the Wedding from Herefordshire. Totally different dances. They might well have been the same one originally, but they've moved and they've changed. So it's still alive. We are still dancing. Younger people are coming into it. They're getting a taste. Some of them will do it all their lives. Others will do it, have a rest, and then come back. Others will lose. That's life. We mustn't be complacent. I'm not trying to encourage that. But I don't think we need to be panicking just because we're getting old and we're frightened that others are not doing what we used to do. They're doing it in a different way. Just to go back to Halsey and how volunteers have influenced what happens at Halsey and done things. I don't remember the exact dates, but it must be 2006 or 2007. We had two weeks that we organised working parties to do decorating. The first one, we decorated the long room. We stripped the walls of all the wallpaper, took all the paint off, we sanded the floor and re-varnished it, and then repainted everything, changed the colour scheme. I consulted with a Dulux paint consultant as to what colours would be best. That's why we ended up with what we've got, because it was his recommendation to get away from the green ceiling that we had and to go over to these colours, which he said were appropriate. They're not everybody's choice, but they went. And we bought new wallpaper, and that was the only thing we had done professionally. And Viv Butler, our office manager, her husband and his partner actually did the wallpapering for us. But everything else, a group of volunteers did. We have a scaffold tower that the manor owns, and we had that up. It was before health and safety was quite as as it is now. We had somebody on the top of the scaffold tower with a bowl of water and vinegar washing all of the chandeliers and taking every little piece off and washing it and then rehanging it. I say, all the paint was stripped off, the plaster work on the ceiling was cleaned down, repainted. And we had two mirrors that we put up on the wall that were donated by friends of Halsey. Not the friends, but people who were friends. It was the mother of one lady who was helping and another lady who was helping who gave them. And those mirrors were bought. The following year, we had another week and we cleaned out the kitchen, absolutely, and decorated that. And it was at that point they had a new oven as well, a new steam oven, which made a big difference to the kitchen. And one of the back corridor, that was the other bit that we did at that time. And volunteers were coming. They were given accommodation and food, but they gave their time. Some stayed for the whole week, some came in for a couple of days, and then others joined in. And we had a team probably of up to 20 people that actually spent the time. And the wallpaper in the long room is the interesting one. It required 26 rolls of wallpaper to do that room properly. And we went to the local supplier. And, we can get that. Then they discovered that actually they couldn't. The manufacturers produced them in runs of 21 rolls with the same code numbers. And you have to order about 3 months in advance if you want more than 21 rolls with the same code number. We actually needed it the following week. So we took a very big gamble and we ordered 26 rolls. 21 were of the same code number and 5 were the next number. Fortunately for us, you actually can't see the join. The 5 rolls we saved till the end and they did the alcove. And the rest was done with the main part and we managed to make it fit. But,
Can see how much volunteers wanted to come and get involved.
Very definitely. Yeah. We put out, I think we put out a message in Set and Turn Single, which is the National Dance Mag, and also talked to people on the grapevine from various parts of the country. And then during the week, although I was technically the board member in charge, Chris Turner did the day-to-day rotas and organised it. And everybody rolled their sleeves up and got stuck in. It was hard work at times, and we were working long hours from soon after breakfast in the morning until 10 o'clock at night. And we got it done in time for a course to come in on the Friday. So, yeah, it was good. And it did look different.